Today we're joined by a true Renaissance woman. She's an author, journalist, and filmmaker who's worked alongside David Lynch and Dennis Hopper. She's the creator of Toshin's Library of Esoterica series, and she's here today to share her journey into the mystical realms we explore all the time on this show, from republishing Manly P. Hall's Secret Teachings of All Ages to unlocking the portals of artistic inspiration. This is a rare insider's look into the heart of esoteric art, film, and culture. Join us today here on Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. Now, while you're listening to this interview, I'm going to put some links in the show notes for you to peruse and check out. The links are going to be for the Library of Esoterica Instagram, as well as the Library of Esoterica website that you can sign up for the email newsletter that she'll discuss towards the end of the interview. And we're going to talk about all kinds of wild stuff, you know, because she wrote books with David Lynch and did work with Dennis Hopper. So she's going to talk to us about them and their artistry. And we're going to talk about how she got into this realm of the occult and the esoteric in her life's journey. This was a super fun interview. And I was actually surprised. And you're going to hear, I'm going to share some stories on there about how odd and sort of synchronistically we linked up through these books that I never in a million years thought I was going to be able to interview her. So stay tuned for that. But check out those links. Follow the Library of Esoterica. Follow Jessica Hundley's Instagram. It's also going to be in the show notes. And if you buy the Library of Esoterica books through her affiliate link through the Library of Esoterica Instagram, I'll put the link in the show notes. If you buy it through that, she sends the profits from the affiliate link to care.org to help women and children in war zones and such. So good cause, of course. And the books are absolutely amazing. Like I say in the show, I don't know how they offer these for $40 a piece. It's insane. These are some of the most beautiful books I have in my library. So it's a real treat to have her join us today. So here we go, Jessica Hundley. Today we've got one of the most interesting guests I've ever had on the show. She's described as a writing creative director and curator of magic. She's the woman behind the beautiful Library of Esoterica, celebrating the art and history of the occult. She's done it all when it comes to art and creativity, from filmmaking to writing to editing to journalism. Having worked for Fader, Dazed and Confused magazine, she's interviewed and collaborated with absolute legends like David Lynch and Dennis Hopper, and she's here today to give us a look into the magical world. Welcome to the show, Jessica Hundley.
Hi there.
Well,
that was quite
now,
an introduction.
Well, you're quite a guest. You know, a really interesting connection here. Like, I'm really into the ideas of the synchronicities that have happened in my life, and maybe 2 or 3 years ago, my sister-in-law asked me what I wanted for Christmas, and I said, I want these Library of Esoterica Toshin books, right? I wanted at the time there was only 3, and you know, and I actually had no idea. Like, I didn't look into who Jessica Hundley was at the time. I just was really into occult stuff, and she got me the 3 books, and I got the books, and you know, and they look very similar to your new one, Spirit Worlds, which, you know, beautiful hardback, tons of absolutely amazing artwork in it. And I have a weird thing about books where I like to write in the margins and dog ear the pages and put notes in them and all that stuff. Because for me, I used to keep things like very, very mint, because I don't know why. I just thought, well, if I ever need to sell it someday, like, you know, whatever. But like over time, I was like, no, that actually makes it more valuable to me to have all my notes in it. And for some reason, there's only a handful of books. Like, I bought a couple of old Kenneth Grant books and these Library Esoterica books that I'm like, I'm not writing in these books. Those are staying mint. So yeah, anyway, I found it very curious that we were able to link up like this. So I wanted to compliment you for these books, which are truly some of the most beautiful works of art that I own. So thank you so much for doing these books.
Well, you're welcome. And I should say what I always say when someone compliments me about the books, which is I am the honored to be the sort of shepherd of these books. And I did conceptualize the idea, but it is very much a team effort with an incredible publisher, Toshin, and then also who I had worked with on other projects before I brought this concept to them, and also the incredible designer Nick Taylor at Thunderwing Studio. And then also just the evolving community of contributors, the artists and the people we interview and the archives we work with. It's really, they're kind of more vessels of a whole community of people past and present who have kind of contributed their ideas and practices and philosophies to the volumes. So I am the high priestess of these books, but certainly not, they are not mine. They are a collective effort.
Right on. And you know, there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about. What I'd like to know is where all of this starts for you, and you can go all the way back to childhood. You know, I really like to hear people's life stories, and I like to understand how people get into these interesting sort of subculture, counterculture, esoteric things, because this isn't the normal sort of path for everybody. So if you don't mind, like, kind of sharing with me, you know, what got you going down this road here?
Yeah, you know, I was only child for quite a while. My brother was born when I was 9, and I grew up in Western Massachusetts, and it's in the Berkshires, in a very sort of haunted landscape of New England, and grew up in the woods, spent a lot of time in nature, and sort of was always very interested in the imagined worlds and fantasy and fairy tale. And, you know, I read all sorts of amazing, you know, all the Madeleine Engel books, sci-fi and fantasy books for kids, and, you know, Lord of the Rings and Narnia series, and really kind of entered the world of ideas through books, I think, probably first. And then pretty quickly after, through music. You know, I was always very into music. I got way into heavy metal as a teenager, early teen, into Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin, which are these bands that have these kind of mythologies around them. And I then became sort of a brooding teenage goth, and was really into Susie Sue and Bauhaus and that whole world. And I think it was really through those kind of cultural touchstones I became interested in first really divination and tarot. There was this amazing kind of witchy hippie store in Northampton that had tarot decks. And I got a tarot deck when I was probably about 11 or 12. And I do think that, you know, particularly kids, and particularly at that cusp liminal age between adulthood and childhood, you really kind of are very powerfully connected to your intuition and also to sort of your inherent clairvoyance. So I became very into tarot. And then, you know, my career really started. I had a zine in my late teens, and I was lucky enough to be sort of like part of the first phase of the zine revolution that kind of took over when, you know, people were able to, you know, use copying machines and printers were suddenly available. And so I had a zine, a culture zine, and started interviewing musicians and filmmakers, then started doing that for a living. So I started my career as a culture journalist and interviewing people about music and art and film, and really kind of was able to build a career doing journalism. And one of the things I always really found sort of continually intriguing and inspiring about that was sort of digging deep into the past and connecting with books, films, albums that had maybe been lost and underground or countercultural, hadn't really gotten their due, and kind of revisiting them, bringing them to a new audience, really. So I work with a lot of reissue labels, writing liner notes, lost records that then were reissued. I have worked with a lot of filmmakers to sort of highlight movies that might have been lost. With Dennis Hopper, I helped to re-release a movie that he made that was shelved by Universal. He made after Easy Rider. And in working with him, he had gotten the rights back, and I was able to kind of help get the movie re-released and restored. It's called The Last Movie. Just kind of being able to give people, you know, we live in this incredible time of, you know, culture at our fingertips, but there is not a lot of curation. There's not a lot of ways to find your way through that sea and to the things that resonate with you. So I like to think that that's kind of where now my career is at a point where I feel like it's kind of my responsibility to be sort of a curator and to people, to kind of point people in the direction of artists and musicians and filmmakers and writers who maybe aren't, you know, never got their full due. We're maybe independent, or maybe the only made one album and, you know, weren't supported by whatever infrastructure, whether it was a studio or a music label or a publisher, things that are out of print and lost. And so that really kind of led me to thinking about how a lot of these occult ideas and philosophies and practices and history have been hidden and made sort of deliberately obtuse or impenetrable or secret, and how really they need to be reintroduced in a way that feels less scary to people, that feels beautiful, that feels totemic, and also explores the history of these practices and the thread of these practices through our culture till now. So each of our books kind of begins with a history section and ends with a contemporary pop culture contemporary section. So kind of that being the thread through, I felt was really important. And, you know, I really kind of feel like all of the work I've done as a journalist, it's kind of really been working towards being able to present these ideas in a way that feels journalistic. And I always say, I in interviews, and, you know, I'm writing about these ideas the same way I would, you know, say, write a Rolling Stone article about a lost record from 1967, where I'm trying to get you excited. I'm trying to reintroduce the value and the, you know, integrity of these ideas, but present it in a way that feels non-dogmatic, that feels, you know, objective, but also, of course, has my enthusiasm for these topics infused in there. So that's kind of the long arc of me and how I got to. And I still do a lot of film and music writing. I'm actually working on some other projects with Tashin that are particularly our film books. So, which is how I got in. My first book with Tashin was actually with Dennis Hopper, and that was about 15 years ago now. And I did many book, music, and film books with them, and then sort of had a relationship, and so presented this idea to do this series, this is sort of encyclopedia of esoteric traditions.
What was like? What was Dennis Hopper like? I mean, he seemed like an I don't know if eccentric is the right word. He didn't. He seemed like he was a interesting guy, right? he seemed like an interesting guy. Like, he wasn't sort of the standard Hollywood celebrity kind of guy, from what little bit I know of the man. You spent some time with him. What do you think?
Yeah, no, he was incredible. He, you know, he started his career in Rebel Without a Cause, became friends with James Dean, and James Dean suggested if he wanted to direct, to give, to start taking photos. And he was acting in a lot of things early on in his early 20s, but also taking photos and also very involved with the art scene here in Los Angeles. And the book I worked with him on was his photographs from 1961 to 67, where he was documenting really his world. And it's just an incredible, like, fly on the wall of, you know, all these amazing artists, all these amazing musicians, people that were his friends, people that he was curious about. One of the things, you know, when I had been a fan of his work, and when I was asked to do the book, I really kind of vowed that I would sort of, you know, sit at the feet of the master and really kind of listen and ask my own questions and learn from him. And, you know, it was supposed to be a very quick 3-month job, and it ended up being a 3-year. He became more and more involved in the process, and it ended up being 3 years that we worked on the book. And he passed about 6 months after the book came out. So I was very fortunate to spend quite a bit of time interviewing him and going through his archives. And one of the things that he still had, and I think is a very important lesson that I learned from him, is he had this deep curiosity about culture, about art, about what was happening in the world culturally, always throughout his life, including when I was working with him in his 70s. He was still, he's an incredible collector of art, had this incredible collection, was still buying art from new artists, was still traveling and going to all the galleries and museums, and still going to see the latest films, and asking me what music I was listening to, like, very curious about the world. And I feel like as an artist, as a creative, it's so important to be looking outside of yourself and not also to be compartmentalizing a certain time period as, like, you know, when the best stuff was happening. He was kind of really awake to everything that was happening in the here and now, as well as, you know, everything that had kind of fed into his own life and career. And I think that was a really important thing to learn from him, because he kind of grew up at a time that I think a lot of maybe of his peers, or maybe even, you know, people of other generations, kind of romanticize as, like, the coolest part music and the coolest films. And he was like, yeah, we did all that, but also there's so much amazing stuff happening now, like, and let's find it, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, he was wonderful. I'm, you know, he's still, out there, you know, I mean, I don't know if I would be doing these books if it wasn't for that experience of working with him and with Toshin for such a long period. Yeah.
Yeah. He, you know, there, speaking of, like, synchronicities, I had a weird sync with him, because not him, but I was back in, like, 2017. I was researching Marjorie Cameron because I did a 3-part episode series on her, because she's super fascinating. She's, like, she's one of the most overlooked figures.
Yeah.
In
she's
the world.
In all, like, our books. We always have a Cameron in our books.
Oh, did you? Yeah, I noticed. She, I think there's a image or two of her in Spirit.
We
Worlds.
Always have her. We're like, what do we have from Cameron? And of course, we also have an image from Night Tide, which is the film that Dennis did.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Is I back when I read. Oh boy, I'm going back too far, but I read a book. It's kind of the seminal book about Marjorie Cameron, I believe. Wormwood Star, and. I read about how she was in Night Tide by Curtis Harrington, and that was Dennis Hopper's first starring film role, I believe. And I, at the time, was trying to find a copy of it. I couldn't really find one. I think maybe, like, it was on eBay for a lot of money. I was like, all right, whatever. I guess I'm not going to watch it. Whatever. It's fine. And a month or two later, I find myself going to Las Vegas, and me and my buddy drove up to Rachel, Nevada, which is where the, I don't know if you're aware, like the ufology stuff of like Area 51, you know? That's where the Area 51 stuff is, and it's where like the legends like Bill Cooper were doing lectures about UFOs and Bob Lazar and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And we went to the little alien, and when we were in there, there's like a little hidden room, and you open the door to this hidden room, and there's a wall of VHS tapes, and staring right at me, right in the center, is a copy of Night Tide. I said, this is so bizarre. Like, it's just, it was just a strange find.
That's Dennis and Cameron working together too. The breadcrumbs to the right people.
and my life's been so weird in that sense. You know, you were talking about how when you're a child, you kind of have this, ability to be in this liminal state of sorts. And I was grounded a lot as a kid. So I spent a lot of time by myself, and I would sit in the yard, and I would find I wouldn't even sit in the yard. I would just walk, and I would find four-leaf clovers just constantly all over the place. And I used to save them. I must have had 30, 40 of these things just saved in a book, and I lost the book. But just weird stuff like that. What I'm saying is there is something to art and going into this other realm. You know, Kenneth Grant would say, like, artists can tap into, like, I don't know, the mauve zone or, you know, dark side of the tree of life. All these kind of, like, strange ideas. And I want to talk to you about the occult real quick and esoteric stuff. And I want to tell you who I am a little bit so we can have this conversation. I am not an occultist. I do not practice. I am extremely fascinated. My whole life I've been completely fascinated with subcultures, countercultures, conspiracy theories, UFOs. I mean, you name it. Like, it's always been my interest. I like to say what Mark Frost said. He said, I'm just a tourist here. And I am an Orthodox Christian, and in Orthodoxy, there's enough mystical leanings in Orthodoxy that I find it to be very fulfilling in a way. Yeah. But I'm also a bad boy. I'm not a good Christian. I'm a lukewarm Christian, and I find a lot of these occult concepts and New Age. I've read just countless New Age books and employed several practices that really were beneficial to my life. I've had psychedelic experiences. I've been in the nude beaches of Maui doing drum circles. Like, I find all this hippie granola stuff that my religion would very much frown upon. Find some of them to be very rewarding, and I try to sort of keep it into perspective. And my audience is comprised of it's an even distribution. I've got sort of your conservative Christians that really condemn all this stuff. Then I've got sort of like occultists that really do occult stuff. And then I've got people like me who are kind of in the middle, and we're just fascinated. We don't, you know, we try not to pass judgment on one side or the other, because what do we know? Who knows what's right? But, you know, I'd like to hear your take on all of this, on spirituality, because you've obviously got a lot of interest in these same subjects. I mean, clearly, right? What's your perspective on all this stuff? And do you find that, like for you, does it just give you inspiration to create art, or does it go further beyond that? Like what's your kind of, what's your vibe on all this?
I would say both. It's, to me, all creativity is sort of tapping into, you know, whatever spirit or source means to you. It's all sort of channeled from somewhere, and it's about sort of figuring out how to clear that channel. And I think, and to sort of live in a way that feels aligned with who you are and the best version of who you are. I was raised Catholic, and very strictly Catholic. I went to Sunday school. I was, you know, went to communion. I had, you know, and abandoned that pretty quickly after leaving the house. But I do find there to be valuable lessons, and I don't necessarily think that any religion, you know, I think it's to me, the religion, sort of Western religion or standardized traditional religious structures, they're all really rooted in indigenous ritual that regard, and by indigenous, I mean, every part of the world has an indigenous culture. So in Christianity, you're really talking about Northern European and, you know, Celtic and Druidic traditions that were then sort of woven into early Christianity. And that's historical and documented. And, you know, a lot of our Catholic holidays are very much related, and Christian holidays are very much related to Druidic and Viking and Celtic holidays, and
the wheel of the year.
Yeah. And it's all really about a relationship that we have to the planet, to, you know, Earth and the seasons, and marking this idea of death and rebirth. And I am very much of the mind that all of these practices, whether you want to get into, you know, astrology hardcore or divination, or you want to, you know, do a sound bath, they all are just ways in. And I think there's a new kind of idea of a new kind of seeking that's happening, especially with young people, of sort of being able to integrate practices that help are helpful to you. And it doesn't mean that you have to abandon the religion that you were raised in, the beliefs that you have. It's just sort of being able to tap into different practices that help you to tap into self, and also to feel as connected as you can to your community, and to be able to move through the world in a way where you are, you know, voicing who you truly are, you know.
I'm with all that. I think that like understanding the practice of meditation in an occult sense, you could argue that meditation is like yoga, where you're yoking or unionizing to some other deity. But for me, I'll do meditation so that I'm not a raging asshole to people. And I find myself, I'll know when I get to the point where I need to like calm down and like sort of shut my brain down and do that sort of thing. I don't know. And that's why I said, like, I'm probably a lukewarm Orthodox, you know, in Orthodoxy, like, they're very...
Prayer is meditation, you know?
I agree.
The prayer beads of the Buddhists is the rosary of the Catholics. It's, you know, prayer is meditation. It's all what helps you to tap into that space of otherness and of source and of spirit. You know,
and these are just these. You wouldn't have the occult, the hidden, without Christianity, because Christianity is what made a lot of this stuff sort of hide in the shadows. So it's kind of like they almost need each other in a weird, sick way.
I feel like say this a lot in the events and workshops and stuff that I do, but I do think that one of the reasons these ideas have been sort of hidden or made evil or scary is because they are very empowering, particularly understanding yourself and understanding your relationship to the world in a way that isn't necessarily intertwined with a deity, with a one God, that's a very dangerous idea. And people being individually empowered to be who they are and not necessarily needing to worship at the feet of a Godhead, that's a very dangerous idea. And I think that the last 2000 years, particularly of Catholicism, particularly of the patriarchy, has made these ideas feel, deliberately hidden these ideas away. Because, you know, astrology is about our relationship to the planets and the stars, and very interconnected with astronomy. It's thousands of years old. It's probably Persian and Chinese in its original form. And then you have, you know, all sorts of goddess cultures and matriarchal cultures that preceded Christianity, which, you know, led to the witch hunts and, you know,
yeah.
So you have, you know, it's very empowering for women, you know, but then yeah. you also have incredible Christian mystics who are, you have Hildegard von Bingen, who was an abbess and a Christian mystic who, you know, really kind of, I feel like any religion you're in, you can find the mystics and the saints or the prophets who were sort of outside the boundaries of that rigid structure throughout history of whatever religion you may have been born into. And I think that's also really important, understanding the history and going deeper with the dogmas and where those dogmas maybe are rooted, I think is really important.
Hmm. Now, to shift gears just a little bit, because I'm already looking at the time. I'm like, damn it, I got to get through some questions here. There's so much I want to talk to you about. Like, I'm a total star fucker, self-admitted. When I look through your you've got a blog with your interviews. I the name of the website escapes me. What it's interviews with icons.wordpress.com.
Yeah.
When I look through your interviews and your photos, and you're hanging with, you know, some heroes of mine, and Dennis Hopper and David Lynch and Glenn Danzig. I don't know if he's a hero of mine necessarily, but I'm absolutely in love with his music. Weird Al Yankovic. I'm like, I'm dying over here. I'm like, this is crazy. And in 2015, you worked with David Lynch on a book called Beyond the Beyond. And when he died, you shared a story, I believe on your Instagram is where I saw it, where you opened that book and this quote opened up to it. And it said, the quote is, one of the qualities of the ocean of pure consciousness within is creativity. So within every human being, there is unbounded, infinite, eternal creativity. And the reason I bring that up is because David Lynch has a very profound impact on my life. I didn't see it coming. Again, I'll be quick. I don't want to talk about me. I want to talk about you, but I wanted to talk to you about Lynch because for years I started blogging about all this stuff in 2011. And for years, everyone kept saying, hey, you got to watch Twin Peaks. And I couldn't get into it. I didn't like it. I was like, I don't know. Why do you want me to watch this? It's boring. I don't get it. And then a couple years ago, I got really sick. And I was stuck on the couch for months, and I was like, all right, let's try this Twin Peaks thing. And I watched it. It had ups and downs for me, and parts of it I liked, parts of it I thought was boring. And I just was like, I don't know. I don't know if I want to like talk about this because it's so much. But then it got in my mind. It got in my brain, and I couldn't let it go. And I just became, this is only 2 years ago. I became obsessed with it. I'm way late to the party. But the thing that, and I'm convinced that it's a connection of Mark Frost's occult studies mixed with David Lynch's ability to present art on the screen in a way that talks to the subconscious, whether it's from him tapping into this unified field of consciousness. And this goes into a whole massive, because I did a 55 episode deep dive into Twin Peaks, all the books, Kenneth Grant, all kinds of stuff. Because it really, for all these years, I was like, this is why people told me to watch it, right? And now I'm like, now I got like Twin Peaks tattoos, and I'm obsessed with it. But anyway, and then also, like, another strange sink is the day we had to put our last Chihuahua, we had to put her down, and it was very traumatic in our house. And the morning we went to the ER to have to do it, I was sitting there waiting for them to, like, kind of bring her out, and I opened my phone, and it was the same day David Lynch passed. And I was like, oh my God, this is the worst week of my life. I was already in turmoil from everything else happening in the world. Anyway. So you've met David Lynch, I'm assuming, multiple times. Like, what was he like? Was he a magician of some kind? How do you think he's able to do this thing? How did he capture so many people with this Twin Peaks and his other films as well? Like, what is so special and unique about him? What do you think that is?
You know, I was lucky enough to interview David several times over the years. And the first time I interviewed him was for Mulholland Drive, actually. And I got to spend time with him. I got to spend time with the entire cast, kind of interviewing all of them. I think it was for some big magazine, but, and you know, he has had this incredible, this comes from a lifetime of being a meditator, centered, direct, focused, kind of very open to intuition. And he actually told me in that interview, and it was, you know, all of the actors also told me, you know, he really cast that film by intuition. And people would come in and they sit and he'd look at them and he'd be like, okay, yes or no. No audition. And it's kind of, and it was Naomi Watts's sort of breakout role. She became a huge, you know, star. She'd been in other things, but his sort of intuitiveness, and obviously there's people he worked with again and again and again, like Kyle MacLachlan, but he really worked from a place of pure intuition, was very open to divine timing. And if he saw sort of like, he had his eyes open to signs, and he weaves those sort of subconscious signs into all of his work. I always tell people, obviously Catching the Big Fish, his book on creativity, is an amazing book. And also I highly recommend listening to the Audible because he reads it. And he also, though, had a sense of humor. And he's also sort of, as a journalist interviewing people, it's, and I'm working right now with Werner Herzog, who is actually, they knew each other well. And David produced a film of Werner's later on. But Werner's the same in that he is presenting a little bit of a meta version of who he is when he's talking about, you know, and David had the same. David was playing David Lynch, you know. So he had a great sense of humor, and you can kind of hear in the Audible version of Catching the Big Fish him laughing a little at himself. You can hear in his voice that he's like laughing at what he's written, not in a way of like disparaging, but like, there is this sort of the trickster, the whimsicalness, him understanding that he has become known to be this sort of obtuse, almost, you know, the sort of almost like Buddha, laughing Buddha character, you know? It was so wonderful because for the book that I did with him, which was about music and meditation and creativity, and music in his films, I got to spend a lot of time with him at his compound that he had, that had a screening room and a library and a music studio and a wood shop. He was a multimedia artist. He painted, he welded, he did all sorts of things. And I kind of got a little bit deeper because I was spending time with him, not talking about film, but talking about music and these things that were obviously he was creating, but were more, he didn't have the sort of, talking to a journalist about Mulholland Drive and kind of putting on this character of the David Lynch, the director. And he really, at that point had gotten very deep. He'd been doing meditation forever, but he was had his foundation that teaches meditation for free in schools and to PTSD, veterans, and also to creatives. So even though it is TM, he had founded his foundation so that he could offer TM basically for free to creatives, because he felt like meditation, particularly for him, TM was this way in, and he wanted to sort of offer it without the dogma.
My boy I was in the military with, he's like the Mexican version of me. He actually got a scholarship and just completed the Lynch TM course. It was maybe 6 months ago, and he's been doing it. I keep following it. I'm like, are you still doing it twice a day? And he's like, yeah. I was like, really? I was like, because I find that so difficult, because I'm interested, but I also think, like, I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I could carve out twice a day like that. You know what I mean?
I've done all sorts of different meditations, and I had actually learned TM when it was still free in the early 90s at Harvard with a teacher that was teaching. I was living in Boston. Was going to college, not at Harvard, but at Emerson, and had heard about this teacher who was teaching TM. A friend of mine had been going. He was offering the classes for free. And I went, and they gave me a mantra, and they, and I really liked it, but I just never, I lost, you know, I kind of lost the habit. And then I've done all sorts of, I'm also the same way of as, you know, I was saying about religion, where I feel like finding the meditation practice that works best with you, and also mixing it up and not feeling like you have to do meditation. Can be anything, walking meditation, a guided meditation, a sound bath, you know. But I really do, when I am doing TM regularly, I definitely notice a clarity and a centeredness. And when I did the book, which was many, many, many years later, I traded my, you know, editorial fee to basically, the book was done in limited edition as a fundraiser for his foundation. So I traded to learn with at his foundation here in Los Angeles to learn TM. And I didn't tell them that I had already learned it. And I asked them, I said, how many mantras are there? And they said, it's like an Ayurvedic thing. It's based on when you were born and your interests, and if you're Vata or Pitta, it's like there's about 30 mantras. And they gave me the same mantra. Which I thought was so amazing, you know.
That is amazing.
And it's really, the mantra is just a sound. It's a sound meditation, really, TM. So it's a made up, it doesn't mean anything. It's a made up tone. That is specifically supposed to be helpful for you specifically. That's why there's like 30 of them to just tap in. And the mantra is just about, you know, repeating it so you can kind of stop thinking and drop in, you know.
Well, let's talk, because again, I got to keep things moving.
Sorry, I'm giving you an answer.
No, this is amazing. I'm enthralled by your answers here. The books that you've been working on, the Library of Esoterica. You also are working on, I believe, in September, releasing a Manly P. Hall Secret Teachings of All Ages reprint with Toshin.
The second edition. We actually released the first edition, which is a replica of the original edition, last year, 2 years ago, and it is sold out. So we are doing a second edition, and then hopefully I wrote a companion book as well that comes in. It's like a giant massive package. Hopefully we are going to do a more affordable companion book. The companion book I did is kind of like a Cliff Notes version, and it has a really wonderful essay by Mitch Horowitz, who is an amazing occult writer and scholar. And I wrote an essay about the inception of the book, how the book was born, through Manly's travels around the world in the 1920s. And I work quite closely with the Philosophical Research Society here in LA, which is Manly founded in the 1930s as a campus for philosophical thought and learning. It has the largest collection of philosophy and occult books in the US. It's an incredible space. And so when I started working on the Library of Esoterica, the first place I went was to the Philosophical Research Society. And they have an original edition of Secret Teachings. The book is out in a million different forms. It's sold millions of copies around the world. But the original edition is this massive tome with these incredible illustrations done by an artist called Jay Knapp, who also painted like the crazy oil painted backgrounds for like Cecil B. DeMille in the 20s. He was a set painter. It's a very Hollywood, you know, story. And so Manly had him paint these incredible paintings, and he basically did like early Kickstarter version. He had subscribers. He had about 500 subscribers who paid $100 each in advance to help pay for the printing of the book. And so there's only about 400 copies in existence. They are utterly beautiful. And I brought Benedict Toshin, the owner of Toshin, to the library and said, there's only 400 of this version of this book. Who better than you to make a new edition? And so we got to work with the library, who they had all of the original paintings in their vault of the illustrations. So we photographed the original, we photographed all the original paintings. The book, it comes with, the Toshin edition comes with these beautiful prints. And then the companion book also comes with this companion book, which has my essay and Mitch's essay, these kind of cliff notes versions of every chapter, but then a lot of amazing art that was created for the book that never made it in. Mm-hmm. Manly has been a really sort of guiding spirit for me for Library of Esoterica. Each of our books ends with our kind of mission statement called For the Seekers. It's the same in every book, the last page of every book. And it sort of talks about, you know, that these books are introductions. They're sort of the key to these worlds and to encouraging people to kind of go and find what resonates with them. And Manly was very much that. He was not a guru. He was not, it wasn't ever about him. It was about presenting these ideas, discussing them, finding the philosophies that felt the most resonant. And the books end with a quote of his, which is, you know, to be in the world without being curious and aware of the world is like being in the world's greatest library and never opening a book.
Yeah, that, I thought that was a fascinating quote. I had never heard that before. I saw that in the back of the book here. Now, and something else in the book, there's two things that kind of connect here, because I was reading through your interview with Glenn Danzig, and I don't know how far back I'm going with that interview, but there was a discussion in there about how you made a comment about how at concerts a lot of people are kind of watching through their phone, like it's a younger generation thing. You know, I was born in 79, so I was raised without a smartphone. So I also feel the same way. I don't go to many concerts, but I feel the same way. I think that's so weird. Like, watch the show. Like, why are you recording it? But I saw something that when I was reading through Spirit Worlds, there's a quote a quote by Tree Carr about how there's, you know, this hypnagogic state of a sort of creative space, and how society is increasing all of our brain activity, which is making it harder to transition from these sort of busy beta wave states to this slower theta state, this hypnagogic state, which is very much a realm of, I would say, the artist. Is that something that resonates with you? Do you think that all of society is kind of over anxious, and maybe that's a because I do think that there is something to being a creative, because I consider myself a creative of sorts. I'm creating content and things and writing books, and watching Twin Peaks, as dumb as this sounds, like watching Twin Peaks has really, and then reading about several of the sort of actors and all the sort of attitudes that went into Twin Peaks, it really made me start trying to lean into tapping into more of my artistic sort of channels. What do you think about that with modern society? Is that something you see happening? Are people like less creative now than they were in the past?
I would say they're as creative, but despite it all, I think that we are absolutely, you know, all of us just bombarded by information. I think it's an incredible thing in some ways. I mean, many, many, many of the artists, contemporary artists in our books, we have found through Instagram, through their Instagram feeds, and not through their, you know, a lot of them don't have galleries, you know, and they're able to make a living with their work through their Instagram. I think the connection that Instagram and that social media offers for artists is very empowering. I think it's also revived the careers and of, you know, someone like a Leonora Carrington or a Hilma af Klint, or, you know, it's been this beautiful medium for the message to spread about art from the past. And for me, as someone who is trying to curate a world and share it, it's been a powerful tool. But I also think that it is, you know, that we are overloaded with media and information. And, you know, it is as simple as turning off your phone and putting your feet in the grass and connecting with nature and connecting with each other in real life as much as possible, and with food and with our senses and with our bodies. I think that and having, you know, experiences like a live concert and experiencing it directly without the phone in the air. I think it's really important for us to be able to find ways to find a balance between the things and to come back into our bodies, really.
Yeah. I did a whole deep dive into dark enlightenment and the philosophies of accelerationism, and there's some elements of the accelerationism that I see, and I'm like, there kind of might be right, where the idea of sort of like this hyper-capitalism thing has sort of warped our experience of what we're intended to be here to do.
Yes.
If anyone's watching the video version of this podcast, on page 353, there's a nice art from Mark Rogers, who you were mentioning about Instagram artists. And I've got one of his reprints on my wall behind me. I don't think you can see it on the shot, but you've got a ton of great art in here. And I saved a whole bunch of images on my computer, because I'm going to try to get some prints to put on my studio wall, because my wife and I always talk about how like there's a certain sort of vibe I'm looking for in artwork, and I don't know how to find that vibe, like just searching around the internet. But yeah, you've curated quite a list here, and I said, holy crap, this is exactly what I'm looking for. So yeah, these books are amazing. And we're out of time, but I do want to get into what projects you're working on right now. What's coming up next for Jessica Hundley?
Well, we are currently working on the 7th volume of the series. So Spirit Worlds is the 6th, and the 7th will be Mystical Beasts, which I'm very excited about. And we are also, the first two just came out of the pocket editions of the book, which I'm very excited about, because they're sort of not 500 pages, they're 200 pages, they're edited down. Pocket edition, still hardcover, of Tarot and Astrology, which were the first two books. Those are coming out, or maybe are on the shelves now. And it's great because, you know, the books are only $40, which we very specifically wanted the books to be beautiful but not crazy expensive. And these are even better, sort of these like appetizers, they're $20 books. I really want everyone to be able to have access to these books and to the art and to the ideas inside them. So we're working on the pocket editions for the second two of the series, which is Witchcraft and Plant Magic. So those will be coming out. And then we're doing a ton of live events and retreats, and the community around Library of Esoterica really kind of trying to take it into real life experiences and gatherings and workshops and all sorts of fun with this Library of Esoterica. So
interesting. Where can we find more about the events and such?
We just put up our website. So we now officially have a Library of Esoterica website, thelibraryofesoterica.com. And then we also just started a newsletter, which we will be, it's free. You can sign up via our Instagram or our website, and it'll have all the stuff that we're doing, but it also have, you know, we have so many incredible artists like Mark, contemporary artists and practitioners like Tree Carr, who are doing stuff all over the world. Tree's based in London. I think Mark is in Seattle. So we try to do an events listings that's like, Mark has a show up if you're in Seattle. Tree's doing a workshop in the UK. So kind of to make sure that we're supporting all the amazing people who have contributed their work, because they're all doing incredible things all over the world. So that's sort of the reason for the newsletter, is really to kind of spread the word for all our artists and let them know they can send us dates and times. And yeah.
Oh, that's great. I'm definitely signing up for that newsletter. Now, that is something else that I found interesting, because I've published my own books through, I self-published every book I've written through Amazon.
Yeah.
I don't know how in the hell you guys are able to print this beautiful, massive, I mean, this it's a hardcover book with full color images. I don't know how this thing comes out to $40. That's a steal.
It's Toshin being very, very nice, and
that is that, you know, tell them thank you.
The Toshin does not make they only make the most beautiful books, and
yeah, I want to get their Shining book.
Yes, it's a incredible book.
So tell us where they can find you and your books, where you'd like them to go for that kind of thing.
Yeah, if you go to our Instagram, there's actually a link tree on the Instagram. And if you buy the books through there, you're buying it through my affiliate link, which we donate all the money to care.org, which works with children and women around the world who are in war zones or hungry or poverty. It's like, you know, 100-year-old nonprofit charity. So we give any of the affiliate money if you buy them through the Library of Esoterica, through either our website or our Instagram link tree, then we'll give anything that we get from those sales too.
Awesome. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. And I love that. That's one of the things that, you know, when I'm trying to, cause this is sort of a show business thing I do, and there's this business side of it. Like, I've got to make my time worth the money that I'm spending on stuff. And that's one takeaway I had from that inspired me from David Lynch, is like, sometimes it's not about that. Sometimes it is about just giving back and just sharing this thing that you love. That's one of the things I'm trying to lean more into and quit being so obsessed with, like, well, I gotta make sure I'm inking out the right profit on this time, and look how long it takes me, you know. It really takes the joy out of it, and it does. Like, it zaps the joy out of it, and I think that's beautiful that you have that that affiliate link for care.org. So I'm gonna put a link in the show notes for the Library of Esoterica website and the Library of Esoterica Instagram, which is where, and then I can even just get the link tree from that Library of Esoterica Instagram.
Yeah. Yes, and I can give you the links for our email sign up too.
Love it. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a real joy talking to you. I've got 100 more questions, but I'm going to respect your time and let you go. So thank you for joining us. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
There you go. If you want to get the books, which I highly recommend, I'm going to put a... In fact, I am working on... By the time I get the show out, I might have it done. I'm working on a set of links for all of the books that I recommend to people, and this is going to be on there. The Library of Esoterica books, their amazing artwork inside of it, interesting occult esoteric subjects, of course. But you can get the books, and you can just follow the Library of Esoterica on Instagram and hit their link tree, pick up the books. And the Toshin Library is amazing, too, by the way. If you're interested in, like, they got a book on The Shining and that Manly P. Hall reprint. Crazy stuff. I mean, beautiful book. So you can check out the Toshin website for more on that stuff, too. So, yeah, thanks again for Jessica for joining us. This was a super fun interview. I love it anytime I can get into the granola inner works of the artist's mind, which is always real fascinating for me. So, lots of links, lots of things to check out. Thanks again for listening. Till next time, stay positive.